Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm calling in today from home. I may have a slightly different sound. I just got back from giving a wonderful talk at a really great college, St. Rose College, just outside of Albany. Marvelous faculty. Had a big staff dinner together, you know, the professors. And the whole atmosphere, unlike so many universities, was caring and even at times loving and thoughtful and intelligent. And people just having good conversations. Then I gave a talk to a few hundred people, including students, very warmly received. The times are also just changing in one really important regard with drugs, and that is everywhere I go, I run into almost zero hostility, in this particular occasion, zero hostility, and a lot of affirmation. People are seeing how harmful the drugs are. They're having experiences themselves. They're seeing it in family members. They're appalled by the massive drugging of children. Times are changing in the public, but not in the pharmaceutical industry, and also not in psychiatry. So they're ramping up. And just like when abolitionists would criticize slavery, they didn't fold. The slaveholders ramped it up. That's what interest groups do. Now, I have a marvelous guest today. I'm not going to start with her yet, but are you there, Jean?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay, well, now, I'll be with you in a minute. I want to tell you a little bit about what's happening with our conference. We have an interesting new offer that goes along with the conference as it comes to upon us. It's just a few weeks away, April 17th, 18th, and 19th, on the Michigan State University campus, the Kellogg Hotel and Conference Center, co-sponsoring with Bertrand Caron, marvelous emeritus professor and friend. Not just to us, but to all people who want to see a better psychology and psychiatry. It's a great facility. Jeannie will be one of the presenters. You're going to get to meet her for the second time on our show. And we really want people to be coming on Friday. We've got a good turnout, but we want people to come on Friday because, you know, I'm going to be giving a big, wonderful opening talk. I'm going to be followed by Robert Whitaker and then Michael Corrigan, who is just does amazing arts, crafts kind of video stuff on debunking ADHD. And then that same day, Michael Cornwall is going to be speaking. And Michael has been around as long as I have in the reform efforts of psychiatry. He speaks as both somebody who's had that lived experience and somebody who's gone on to be a therapist and a leader. And then we're going to hear about the Copeland Center and unique ways in which self-help and peer support is really spreading as a program for everything and around the world, and even getting some government support, which is interesting because they do not promote drugs. You know, self-help for everything from quitting smoking to handling your potential for your psychotic break. You've had a few before. The RAP program helps you figure out for yourself how you know it's coming and what you can do to help it out. Then we're going to, in the evening, we're going to have a talk by Karina Hackinson from Sweden about farming communities hosting people in emotional crises. So we want so much to get you there on Friday, because it goes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoon, that we're adding a free dinner Friday evening. So So when you go to empathictherapy.org and you sign up and you pay your admission price and come to the Friday and hopefully Saturday and Sunday session, you're going to get a bonus that only you're going to hear on this radio show. It is not on the website. And the bonus is, for the same price, you're now getting a really good free evening meal from 6 to 7:30. So where it says Friday dinner is on your own, come back for dessert, actually, it's going to be Friday dinner on us, literally on our center. We want to get you there on Friday. We're really looking forward to that. Well, Jeannie Stolzer. I love Jeannie Stolzer. I like and I care about a lot of my guests, and some of them are friends, but I love Jeannie Stolzer. She's a professor, I guess you'd call it child development and family. And she's in Kearney, Nebraska, where I gave a talk, thanks to Jeannie, to about 600 people. I mentioned this to some of the professors at the St. Rose, and they said, well, it sounds like the whole town came out. Jeannie has a deep interest in evolution. She studies anthropology. She cares about relationship and attachment. And we're going to start out, I'm going to ask Jeannie to tell you, what is attachment theory? What's it all about? And maybe even, well, how has some elements of it been criticized? And we're then going to relate attachment theory to everything good in reform psychiatry, because I think attachment theory and its fundamental principle is exactly what I say whenever I speak and write, which is relationship is what heals. Relationship is what makes us human beings. Relationship early on often disrupts our growth and development, and then even more so, we need relationship to heal. So Jeannie Stolzer, I give the mic over to you, and just tell us about, say hello, of course, and tell us about attachment theory.
Well, hello. I'm so very happy to be with you, Peter. Thank you so much for having me. Attachment theory, John Bowlby is the father of attachment theory, and his work is absolutely incredible, and it goes on and on for decades. But the basic nucleus of attachment theory is that we have this innate primordial need for attachment. I think I can quote Bowlby by saying, all baby mammals need their mother or their permanent mother substitute in order for optimal development to occur. So from the very beginning, what he meant by a permanent mother substitute, it doesn't have to be your biological mother. Of course, it could be your father, or it could be an adoptive mother, or, you know, across mammals, a goat could adopt a German shepherd. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you have this secure base and that you know that you are intently and intensely loved and that you're cared for, and that relationship will not end until death.
Keep going, Jeannie. I'm not going to let you off that easy.
Yeah.
Though, that is so important. You know, it dovetails with what I say in my new book, In Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and that is that the brain quadruples in size in the first couple of years of life. No other mammal has that experience. And indeed, as many folks some of the specialists have described it, we, unlike other mammals, are born in a kind of fetal condition. We can barely live outside the pouch. We really need complete nurturing. We're helpless. We can't feed ourselves. We can't walk. We can't get around. We can't clean our skin. Can't defend ourselves from bumblebees or anything, bumblebees, stinging bees or anything else. So
That's actually called the fourth trimester. You know, you hear about the three trimesters.
No, I hadn't heard that expression. That really fits.
Yeah, it's called the fourth trimester because you're right. All the primates, not just humans.
Let me
all the primates, baboons, the chimps, the gorillas. We are all born where we cannot imprint because we cannot follow our attachment person. They are responsible for what kind of relationship occurs. And so that fourth trimester is that time that you're attached to your mother. I'm talking physically attached to your mother. She wears you on her body. You nurse on demand. You sleep with her. She's there all the time. That's the formation, according to attachment theory, of secure attachment later in life. And many, many, many Americans don't have this. And then we walk the earth thinking, what's wrong with us? Something's just not right. I just feel sort of a disequilibrium, and they can't put their finger on it. But what it is that fear that you write about so eloquently in your book, that fear and that anxiety that I'm not safe here.
Now, the importance, by the way, folks, I think this is a really important show. So if you don't get to hear it all, you know, come listen to the download. I mean, we're talking about the most basic stuff there is. Now, the importance of the brain quadrupling, unlike in any other animal, in the first few years, and doubling in the first year, is that the brain is growing in response to the nurturing that Dr. Stolzer is describing. So your brain quadruples in the intimate presence of one or two caregivers, and maybe a lot of other folks helping if you're in an extended family, or if you're growing up, 1,000 or 10,000 years ago, or 1,000,000 years ago when we were bipeds, but mammals nonetheless. So we grow up to have a social brain because all the new fibers that are connecting, all the neuronal connections and all the development of synapses and all the pruning back that also occurs where certain neuronal clusters don't go on and others become more and more elaborate. All of that is about that basic nurturing you're having at the age of zero and on. That what Jeannie's calling the fourth trimester, which I'd never heard before. And so we are social. We are we're the most social mammal. We're the most social creature on Earth. And there's no getting away around it. And that turns psychiatry on its head. It really just throws the whole ideas about biochemical and genetic imbalances. It's about relationship.
Yes.
So pick up on Jeannie and some more.
Well, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm thinking, you know, when you think about us as human beings on planet Earth, for 99.99999% of our time on this planet, we have been nurtured in very specific ways. And just over the last 100 years, some places it's 70 years, we have turned this nurturance upside down. We're not even recognizable as a species to what we were. And what I'm talking about is, from birth on, our mothers are drugged beyond recognition with epidurals and Pitocin and all kinds of narcotics that are going directly crossing the placenta into the baby. So the baby's born drugged. Now remember that the dosage of drugs given to the mother who's laboring is based on her weight, not on the baby's weight. So, of course, the baby is impacted significantly more than the mother. So that's number one. The baby's born drugged. Number two, we have all these hospital policies that we take baby away immediately. It's unbelievable. Babies, baby mammals, nurse immediately upon birth for many, many reasons. And one is to expel the placenta. But the most important reason mammals do that is so that attachment formation can become a reality immediately after birth. We're not allowing this either. Then as the child gets older, 42 days older, 6 weeks, we put them in a daycare center. And how we're raising our children today, it bears no resemblance whatsoever to our species of the past. And then we're having all of these problems. We call them psychiatric illnesses. And we scratch our heads and say, why is this occurring? We don't feel safe.
That's amazing, Jeannie. I've never heard you put it that way, or if you did, it kind of escaped me. So we're kind of growing up with what philosophers, I think looking at it upside down, have called existential anxiety. But
yeah.
The existential anxiety is not about recognizing our death or recognizing the meaninglessness of the universe. The existential anxiety is about the attenuation, the imperfection of our early existence.
Exactly. Perfectly stated.
Wow.
But we want to make it a medical problem. But if you do this to any other mammal, if you take a baby lion and do all those things that I just talked about to a baby lion, it's drugged when it's born, at, you know, at its earliest infancy, it's raised by, you know, uninvested strangers. It's simply not going to be performing at its highest lion function because it's not safe.
You know, it reminds me of the now infamous Harlow experiments where infant monkeys were separated from their mothers with disastrous results. And Jane Goodall writes about one of her beloved chimps who was born to a relatively elderly mother who wasn't good at nest making anymore, wasn't good at nurturing anymore, and the attachment didn't develop very well. So that when she died of old age, and little Flint was his name, was 4 or 5 years old, he didn't survive. He died of, I guess Bowlby called it anaclitic depression, was that right?
That's right, yep.
God, that's pulling it out of my background, but because Flint died, and the other chimps couldn't reach him. They couldn't build attachment with him as they would have with a normal monkey whose mother had died when he was 4 or 5. A normal monkey chimp would have gone on. And Goodall describes how this is due, this depression he falls into, little Flint dies from. It's due to the fact that he didn't have adequate bonding to begin with. Again,
yes.
These are the truths about life, folks. This is what it's about, this kind of thinking.
The nucleus of attachment theory is time. And that's where Americans get so cantankerous about this theory. They want it to be biology. They want it to be biology. It is not biology. It is time. It is the people, the person that spends the most time with you, because you cannot form a secure base without time. But we've lost that in this country. I mean, really look at how we're raising children. It's amazing. You're in a daycare from 6 weeks. You've never been suckled at your mother's breast. You've never slept with your mother. And then you're supposed to go out into this great big world and you're supposed to perform. And we wonder why we're so anxiety-ridden and so neurotic. We didn't have our earliest needs met.
Jeannie, and going back to Bowlby's, which I didn't expect to talk about today, going back to Bowlby's studies, there comes a time as he tracks these infants in Great Britain, some of whom are being removed, as I remember, because of the Blitz. And he finds,
oh, yes, I love this. Yes.
Yeah, and he finds out, you know, it's better to be in the Blitz with your mother than to be sent out to other people in a nice, calm residential area outside London.
Powerful what you just said is. We know that's true. His research is quantifiable and it's published. We know because of his work that it's better for children to stay in the eye of the storm, literally in the bombings, with their secure base than to go to a safe place with others who they don't have that secure base with. That's monumental.
It's funny, you know, we've never talked about this, but you and I have gotten such similar things from reading Bowlby, and I think I read him 45 years ago. I looked at him a little bit more for the new book. Now, Bowlby, and I don't remember this, I'm just using you here, Jeannie, Bowlby says that they found that there was an age at which if you removed the infant before that age, the infant would bond with another long-term caregiver.
Yes.
And there's an age after which it won't happen. Do you remember what age he was talking about?
Yes. Attachment in human beings is not solidified until 4 to 5 years. It's still forming. It's still you know, becoming cemented. So this is terrible to say, but the earlier you would lose your primary attachment person, the more likely you would be able to establish another relationship. But once that's permanently, you know, solidified, it's going to be a long, hard row to do that.
I thought the age was much younger. You're saying 4 or 5 years?
No, no. What I'm saying is that the attachment in humans is not completely solidified for
okay.
4 to 5 years.
But the child still who loses at a much earlier age than that, loses the initial primary parent, still suffers.
Absolutely. 100%.
And that's like, what, 18 months?
Yeah, I think he was writing about 12 to 16 or 18.
Okay. All right, so we've got two different time periods. So within the first year anyway, you can get a new attachment and who becomes permanent, not just a new one and new one and new one. And you're going to be okay, presumably. But once you start to get a bit older than that and you lose that person, well, maybe by 4 or 5, you're saying you've at least had some solid attachment experience.
Yes, and if you really think about this, across all mammals, across all cultures, and across all time, infancy and early childhood, so from birth to about 5, for humans, is for one thing and one thing only, and that is cementing attachment. That is what it's for. And we're not viewing it that way anymore. We want our kids in some high-powered, highfalutin preschool at 2, and then we brag to our friends they can speak German and play the cello. That's great, and that looks really good for the parents, except what about attachment processes that are not even fully formed yet? So we've lost our own wisdom. We've known, and these, you know, people 3,000 years ago were not educated with PhDs or MDs, but they knew that there was a critical point in development that attachment needed to be solidified, and that's how they raised their young.
Are the chimps the ones nearest to us? Because I remember all kinds of stories about elephants and attachment, too, but I don't have any scientific base to it.
Oh, absolutely. Read the ethological data out there. I mean, we've got it so backwards when it comes to other mammals, particularly dolphins and elephants, the wolves. I mean, these are very complex familial structures. It's we've sort of missed the boat here. And yes, I am closer to a female chimp molecularly than I am to you, because me and you differ by one full chromosome, and me and the female chimp do not.
I don't believe you just said that.
It's true. It's true. We're really different, man, woman, very, very, very different, even though, sorry, I might get hate mail for this.
I was going to say, you're going to get in so much trouble for this.
I am,
well,
let's
talk about that. Let's not let this one go. It's a little bit different than the main theme here, but how different are men and women, male and female?
They are so different. And, you know, I'm old enough that I can remember when this argument was theoretical, meaning that, you know, the social constructivist movement would talk about, no, it's all socially constructed. We give little boys, you know, tanks and guns and arrows, and we give little girls dollies and teacups. Of course they're different. We raise them that way. It's socially constructed. And the more biological bent theoreticians would say, no, this is biological. It's neurological. It's hormonal. So I lived when it was still theoretical. Thank God I lived long enough that it's not theoretical anymore. With the advent of brain imaging, MRI, CAT, PET scans, we know male and female brains are different. Now, are there outliers? Of course there are. There's always males who look much more female and females who look much more male. They're called outliers. For most of us, our brains are so completely different. The Broca's area, the hippocampus, the prefrontal lobes, the frontal lobe. I mean, it's crazy. We're so different neurologically. Think about the different hormones we're secreting on a daily basis. Males typically really high in testosterone and androgen. Females typically very high in estrogen. These are completely and totally different hormones. But we don't want to recognize this. We want to say that gender is socially constructed, and the science is clearly saying it's not.
Tell me about I mean, this is a lot of this is just new for me. It's got to be new for a lot of people listening. And we've got about 4 or 5 minutes before our break. Tell me about the differences in brain and how much can you attribute it to genetic influences, how much to hormonal. They're connected, of course, but they are different. You could change hormones artificially. So how much, if you know, if anybody knows, what are the differences in brain?
Oh, brains are so different. But if you go back to our very first human beings that walked this planet, you have to think about what males had to be good at. And I don't mean should be good at. They had to be good at it for their line to survive. They had to be very territorial. They had to be highly active. They had to be highly combative, protective. These were the things that ensured their line survived. Females, on the other hand, had to be very, very nurturing for children for their line to survive, and they also had to be multitaskers. And if you look at brains right now, we really do have a right and a left side of our brain. We really do, and they control very different things. Males tend to stay on that right side, that analytical side. Females have much more lateralization in the brain. They can go right, left, right, left, right, left. And when you look at our evolutionary past, that
is the corpus callosum, you know, that the track that connects left and right, the corpus callosum, is that bigger in females? That's interesting.
It's much bigger, and it can track all the back
serious.
And forth.
You know this.
I know this.
Oh, my God.
You can see it on MRI, imaging studies. This is not theoretical. This is a fact. And, of course, we're different. And directionality, I forgot that, too. Males had to be really good at directionality because they were the hunters. They would get miles and miles from the family cave or the family hut, and they had to know which way was north, south, so they could get home. Females, not so good at that. Watch females when they're telling each other directions. They say things like, go to the white church and take a right, and then go 4 blocks and turn left at the red house. That's how they talk. Males, on the other hand, say go 2 miles north, a fourth of a mile south. We don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I'm probably a cross over there, but I have no sense of direction anyway.
And that's okay. But you can be an outlier. Outliers are
I'm
good.
I'm an outlier, so I can sit home and write books.
That's right, and they're necessary. But from our evolutionary past, it makes perfect sense why we're so different. And look at our kids in the school system, how differently they learn. Oh, my God. How differently they input. How differently they socialize. It's simply amazing.
You're listening to the amazing Jeannie Stolzer, professor at Kearney, Nebraska. Is there a way you would like people to be able to get in touch with you?
Sure, they can email me at Stolzer, it's S as in Sam, TOLZERJM @unk.edu.
Say it one more time.
Stolzer, STOLZERJM @unk.edu.
Folks, I'm not feigning all of this wowness. I'm actually experiencing this. Jeannie and I have never gone in this direction in a conversation. I'm learning hand over foot. It's amazing the information she has, and it's forbidden information. It's forbidden to talk about differences between men and women that are biologic. And, of course, it doesn't mean that any man or woman can't lift their spirit in a different direction. But nonetheless, we start with certain givens, at least statistically, even though there's going to be huge overlap. Let's go to break. And when we come back, I have no idea what amazing new insights we're going to get from Jeannie Stolzer. Hi, folks. I hope you're finding this show as interesting as I am. This is April 1st. 17 days from now, on Friday the 17th, the Empathic Therapy Conference. Find out all about it on empathictherapy.org or go to Bregan.com and you'll find a link. But Empathic Therapy, I'm a little hoarse because I spoke all day yesterday away at the college. Come to the conference. And when you go, remember, when you go and sign up and you look at April 17th, which is a Friday, the conference is Friday, Saturday, and half-day Sunday, it says that the dinner's on your own, but we're actually giving you, literally, the center, our nonprofit, is giving you dinner. And then you can stay in the evening and hear a really, really interesting conversation with a very innovative woman from Sweden who's working on new ways through farming families of helping very distressed people. And just a word about my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. It's turning out to look like my best-selling book since that whopping one, Talking Back to Prozac, a while back. People are looking for new understandings. And we may not get to talk much about it today with Jeannie because she is just bringing up all new and exciting stuff. But I put the wisdom I have and a whole new concept of guilt, shame, and anxiety coming out of evolution. Evolution. It's really, in a word or two words, it's nature's anger management. That's why we got guilt, shame, and anxiety. And it doesn't work well. It actually holds us back. Evolution is imperfect. And we probably are just a million miles away from genetically perfecting that particular array of emotions, if ever. And I talk about how to identify those emotions, how to get your emotional profile, how to control them, and how to replace them with principles, with love, with better attachments, which that's guilt, shame, and anxiety. And you can get it with a super bonus on our website, the Antidepressant Factbook, which is still in print. We got a whole bunch of them at a really nice price. So if you buy Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety at the regular price, you get the you get the Antidepressant Factbook at the same time. So
you have to get this book. I saw the book before it actually came out, read a little bit of the manuscript, and this book is life-changing. People, you have to get a copy of this book. It's that good, and it doesn't surprise me at all that it's going really, really up the charts because it is unbelievable.
Thank you. Well, what have you been thinking while at the break? Where do you want to take this amazing conversation? We left off with differences between men and women, and I managed to remember the name of the neurological connection and from what between the left and the right side of the brain. And building on what you were saying, I guess that women had a much bigger connectivity between the two sides of their brains because of all this multitasking, and you said yes.
Absolutely.
You can see it on MRI?
You can see it on MRI. No longer a theoretical debate. But I do want to tell you a story, if you'll humor me for a minute. It just happened to me yesterday. A friend of mine who's a professor is going back to school to get another degree to be a therapist. And we're having tea, and she says to me, can you believe how far we've come when it comes to mental illness? And I said, say more. Tell me what you're thinking. And she said, well, honest to God, we used to believe it was demons that caused all this mental suffering and anguish. And I looked at her for a long time, and I said, how far we've come? Now we say it's a chemical imbalance of your brain. There's no more evidence for a chemical imbalance of the brain than there is for demons. What are you talking about? We've came this far. I think I may have overstepped my bounds, but it's just a scientific fact. You want to talk to me about chemical imbalance this and chemical imbalance that? You can't measure the serotonin, dopamine, or norepinephrine in a brain. It's like demons. There's demons there. There's a chemical imbalance here. It's driving me nuts because I'm a scientist. Okay, thank you for humoring me.
It's been driving me nuts for decades and decades. And now we have the former editor-in-chief of Clinical Psychiatry News, a fellow named Pies, P-I-E-S, saying, psychiatry keeps being accused now of believing in biochemical imbalances. We've never believed in that.
Never.
No informed psychiatrist believes in biochemical. My colleagues, they don't care about truth. The misfortune is it's about power and authority, drug company connections and money. The only attachment psychiatry has is to the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, and you talk about that in your book. Now, really, let's look at what's causing all of this emotional pain and suffering. What is the cause? And clearly, there's no evidence for a chemical abnormality in the brain, because if there were, we would be sending these people to neurologists.
Well, neuroscientists.
Right. Not to psychologists or MSW therapists. What? So that was my new thought.
Let me pick up on a new theme.
Okay.
If you think about who comes to therapy, when people come to therapy, it's almost always about broken attachments.
Yes, it is.
The vast majority of people I see are coming in because their marriages are in desperate condition. Their relationships with their children are in desperate conditions. Sometimes their work relationships are going sour again, and they want to change that. And often underlying it, but they may not know it, is their ongoing relationships with their parents, even though they're 50 years old. That is, the client's 50 and the parents are 70 or 80. But those relationships are still in some way plaguing them. It's all about relationship and attachment.
And if Bowlby's right, he said that the earliest attachment figure we had, our primary attachment person, creates our internal working model, which is the prototype for all future relationships that we have. So that would make perfect sense in what you're talking about, that these people never had a secure attachment. So then they grow and they start families of their own, and their marriage is in shambles and blah, blah, blah. It all fits. We've known this since Bowlby's seminal work in the 40s. Really, we have. And we keep doing things that are the antithesis of what he told us to do. And that is, we leave our babies at 6 weeks old. Our national policies do not support paid maternal leave. We do nothing to support attachment parenting in this country. Do you know we are the only country on the planet that does not provide paid maternal leave? And you're going to say, no, Afghanistan does not. Yes, they do. The richest, most educated, powerful country that the world has ever seen refuses to pay for maternity leave to secure attachment in early childhood.
How long are the paid maternity leaves in, say, Great Britain, Canada?
You're asking me to really search in my brain. Sweden, Norway, Finland are the longest.
Are they a year or what are they?
No. 3 years, you know, and
it's several years.
Yes. Yes.
Oh,
it's years. Britain, I believe, but don't quote me on this. I think Britain is 4 months, but it could be 6 months.
No, people can Google it. We get folks out there working on the problem.
It's full paid maternal leave. And they also get child allowances checks all over Europe.
Yeah.
So we say in this country, you know, we provide lip service that our kids are our future and they're so important. Then put your money where your mouth is and start enacting policies that are best for kids and families. You're not doing that. You're making it harder. As a matter of fact, it's tax season right now. Do you know how many tax breaks you get if you put your kids in daycare? But we don't give one tax break to a parent who's raising a child, not one. There's financial incentives to put your child with uninvested strangers. It's incredible.
It's very important stuff you're talking about. Do you think kindergarten, which is what, age 4.5 or 5, am I right about that, is that too early?
Well, according to Bowlby's theory, attachment in humans is solidified from 4 to 5 years, so he would say that you do have a secure base. You know, you've got all your words or many of your words. You can talk. Yeah, kindergarten would be okay, according to attachment theory, because, you know, you've had that secure base for 5 years. You can go out and explore now. You can go out and do this. And probably most importantly, you can talk to your mother or your father. You know, somebody's touching me here or this happened. When you're 10 months old, you can't tell anybody if somebody hurt you or inappropriately touched you or that you were scared or terrified. You can't tell anybody.
Well, I'm going to mention something that maybe you and I will talk about. By the way, folks, on Saturday at our conference, which would be the April 18th, Jeannie and I are going to just go toe-to-toe for an hour. It's going to be just a joint presentation, and we're just going to talk about these issues and interact with the audience around these issues. And here's something that I'm just going to mention. I've never talked in any depth about this publicly. I was raised until age about 4.5 by a youngster who was 16 when she came to be with us. She was a black child of age 16 from a southern farm. My mother, I guess, just didn't want to be troubled with one more boy. She already had one. And so I was raised until about 4.5 when they told her leave. And I might go into a little more detail at the conference. I'm not sure what I'll do. But I've always thought in ways I can't possibly understand that that helped make me the social critic that I am, the person who's able to stand alone that I am. But I'm not as sure exactly about all that.
She had a profound effect on you, didn't she?
Oh, my gosh, yes. So I think one of the reasons I'm spiritual, because there was no spirituality in my family, but I think that, it was a Jewish family. I think that that she brought some element of Christianity secretly into our relationship.
Did you trust her? Did you feel secure with her?
Oh, I'm sure that I believed that I was a little black child that
yep.
just happened to look white.
Just happened to look a little different.
Yeah, right.
It's amazing. We all need that. And I was quoted in USA Today by, all I did was quote Bowlby's seminal research, and I said baby mammals need their mother or permanent mother substitute, like this person you're talking about, in order for optimal development to occur. Oh, my God, deluged with,
mm-hmm.
What are you talking about? You know, you're putting all this, blah, blah. What am I talking about? It's just scientific fact. It's ethological data. We need to feel safe and secure. It's a consistent, loving person who's there to love us, protect us, teach us, discipline. We need that. It's not a want. It's a need. And have you noticed that Bowlby calls this a cardinal need? Attachment is not anything different than sleep or food, water. It is a need, period, according
well,
to Bowlby.
Well, it's formative of us as creatures, as beings. Now, one of the parts of attachment theory that has been especially controversial has been the nursing on demand, because people envision, you know, 12-year-olds coming up to their mothers and nursing in public. Tell us about nursing on demand. What happens in the cultures we've been able to study who are pre-modern, and what happens in various modern cultures where nursing on demand exists?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because that's one of the ways that we can illustrate how completely different we are than our ancestors. Nursing on demand occurs across every culture. Most of us have seen a cat or a dog with their babies. When they're little, when they're newborns, they nurse constantly, through the night, through the day. You think, poor cat mother, God. As the babies get older and go out to explore, they don't nurse as much. There's no veterinarian telling them she has to wean. They know when their needs have been met, their oral needs have been met, and breastfeeding in all species, in all mammals, is so it's so natural, for lack of a better term, because it starts off so intense, and then it gently decreases. And that's what's so weird. The mother cat never knows that this will be the last nurse. And the mother human, in, you know, thousands of years previous to ours, never knew it either. Because it wasn't on the advice of a pediatrician or on the advice of a mother-in-law. It was the baby's, the child's needs. And we get so worked up with humans with this on-demand, child-led weaning because we're so afraid that it's going to make them these dependent, squirrely, you know, whiny. And the research shows just exactly the opposite. Look at McKenna's research with breastfeeding and co-sleeping. He's been doing it for 40 years out of Notre Dame. Shows just exactly the opposite. These are highly independent kids and adolescents and adults. We're so afraid. But when we watch the mother cat or the mother lion nursing, we don't look at that little lion and say, oh, my God, he's sleeping with his mother and he nurses whenever he wants. He's going to be such a clingy, whiny, neurotic adult. We know he's not. He's getting his needs met when they're supposed to be met, and then he goes out and becomes the king of the jungle. But he doesn't do that by not getting his needs met. He has to get his needs met before he can be the king of the jungle.
Yeah, I can really see how not getting your needs met in the first few years in terms of intimacy or nursing would really lead to a kind of constant state of dissatisfaction and anxiety. You're gonna get me into doing a lot more reading on this, but in the meanwhile, I'm just going to keep on tapping your enormous knowledge about it.
Look, Erickson's writing, Trust versus Mistrust, that first year of life.
Yeah.
According to Erickson, and of course he's a Freudian, a psychoanalytic theoretician, but according to Erickson, that first year, that first 12 months, is when we determine as human beings if this planet, this place we live, is safe. Are our needs met? Are we nursed? Are we held? Are we stroked? Are we in a state of being terrified all the time, that our needs are never met and we don't know what to expect? It's pretty amazing to think about it.
By the way, I think you're selling Erickson a little short. Eric Erickson, he really was a man of expansive social thinking, and certainly I wouldn't just say psychoanalyst. He certainly wasn't stuck.
No. I didn't mean to imply that.
Yeah.
Ego psychologist, he took it way
past that, yeah. A whole different direction.
Yeah, he did.
What is the best book? If one person, we're going to get on and go on Amazon and buy a book by Bowlby instead of Bregan for the day. Ginger, forgive me. My wife is always encouraging me to promote myself. What book by Bowlby would you get?
Attachment and Loss, hands down.
Okay. And I'm going to... Go ahead.
It's going to talk about all of his data, how he collected his data, and how he used this theory. And if you know about Bowlby's background, most people don't. The father of attachment theory was born to an aristocratic English family and was raised by a succession of nannies. He never had a primary attachment person, never. That's Bowlby. So when they say that the greatest theoreticians are the wounded healers, I think they're onto something. Because he knew what was missing in his life. He knew he never felt secure, and he knew why. Did you see his, this is my favorite research that he's ever, well, I probably can't say my favorite because I love him so much, but one of the most amazing projects that he did was he took children who were more American-raised. They were bottle-fed, crib-sleeping, daycare kids, and he compared them to kids that were more primordially raised, meaning breastfed on demand, child-led weaning, mother-raised, and he took them to parks. And the only direction the parent had, the mother had, was to let the children play. And these children are between 3 and 5 years of age. Just let them play. And him and his research assistants were coding this data, and about 94% of the kids who were bottle-fed, crib slept, daycare, stayed right by their mother's thigh, and they wouldn't go play. And about 92% of the children who were more primordially raised went out and played. And so what he did with that data is say, this makes perfect sense. When you're afraid that you're going to be left all the time, of course you don't have the security to go play. So you stay, and you hug her thigh. And why do you hug her thigh? Because she leaves you all the time. The other ones didn't have that need to be clingy. They knew if they looked over her shoulder, she'd be there, because she always is.
Intuitively, I really see that as being absolutely true. You have to build the foundation first, and then you have the strength to move on.
Yes,
I think
that's it.
Incredibly important.
Yes, but so many people take this. I want to make sure I clarify this. There is a difference between attachment parenting and neurotic parenting. Attachment parenting allows the child all kinds of developmental milestones. They get to go out and do whatever they get to do because it's developmentally appropriate. Neurotic parenting, on the other hand, is you're scared to death. So you're not going to let them do this. They can't climb the fence, or they can't climb the tree because you're too scared they'll fall. That's not attachment parenting. That's neurotic parenting.
I want to emphasize, as we get near to the end, Jeannie, we have about, and by the way, folks, again, I'm talking with Jeannie Stolzer. She and I will be doing a conversation together at the upcoming April 17th, 18th, and 19th conference with a free dinner on Friday, despite what it says. When you go to empathictherapy.org and you pay for the conference, it says dinner's on your own, but we've decided to pay for dinner Friday night for everybody with no increase in your price. She and I are going to be having this really continuing great conversation. This is just a warm-up. I want to emphasize the importance of relationship healing us later on in life. And I deeply experience it personally, the healing I've had, being with more than 30 years with Ginger, the healing that the people have with teachers that they meet and trust, or a therapist, or a minister, or a rabbi, an athletic coach. And you know how often, you know, you watch these kids who come from really difficult backgrounds and how much they love their coaches. It's all about attachment. It's all about attachment. And healing is possible. It's not like you get permanently wrecked. It's just that you got extra work maybe to do and deeper understanding to overcome some of the anxieties you may bring from poor attachments early on. But you have the capacity to heal as an adult through relationships. Jeannie, you're not a therapist, but I'm sure that's your experience too.
It's critical. That's right. I'm so glad you said that. We can heal. We can heal through trust and love. It's relationships.
Thank you, folks. I hope some of you will come up to me April 17th and say, thank you, Peter. I'm here because of your radio show at the conference. Go to empathictherapy.org. Talk to you next week, folks. Thank you, Jeannie.
Thank you.